I pointed out a parallel between God and Ahasuerus. Now, that doesn't mean that Ahasuerus was a good man or a righteous man. It just means there are some parallels in the kingdoms of each and their power. Now, in the kingdom, Ahasuerus' kingdom was all the way from Persia to the east, or India rather, to the east, and down to Ethiopia in Egypt. God's is from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. The kingdom of Ahasuerus was a very glorious kingdom, so of course is the kingdom of God. Third, we pointed out that the palace or throne of Ahasuerus was a very splendid and was noted for its splendor. The throne of God is represented in Revelation 4. Is also a great and splendid and glorious kingdom. The authority of both was absolute, one of them in the political realm, the other in the spiritual. Both gave commandments. Those of the Persian king were irrevocable. They could not be revoked, nor can God's. But when Ahasuerus gave the commandment, authorized the slaying of the Jews, he couldn't take that back. But what he could do was to give another law in which the Jews could defend themselves from the attack of the enemies. What God did, since the sin against God, and I mean since sin is against God, God cannot take back that law that all unrighteousness is sin. But he gave us a law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus by which we can save ourselves from the consequence of it. Then Ahasuerus had the power to put away Vashti, his wife, because she disobeyed him. God had a right and did put away Israel, according to Jeremiah chapter 3 and Isaiah chapter 50. He put them away because of their rebellion and sin against him. Ahasuerus took him another wife, Esther. Jehovah took him another wife, the spiritual Israel. So these are some of the points that we made last time, which I think were very interesting, which I've never noticed before. Now then, in our lesson today, now we're in the third chapter, in the fourth chapter, we come now to the effort of Haman to destroy the Jews. Now, in Mordecai's word to Esther, that deliverance would come from some source. The point is that a God is powerful, as was is Jehovah. He was able in his providence to keep the Jews from being destroyed. Right? And so that's what we're looking at now. The providence of God in raising up Esther, bringing her to the throne, that she might be the instrument of God in saving the Jews. And that's our lesson today. So I think this is a very exciting book to me, a very interesting book. It's all like reading a short story. I remember back when I was a boy at Saturday Evening Post, called for the nickel then. It had a nickel, but in it would be short stories. I always liked those short stories in the Saturday Evening Post. Reading this to me is like reading a short story. Here you've got all the emotion and excitement in it, conflict and all of that, and love, marriage, and things of that nature. But I think it's like reading it. I got interested in reading it yesterday studying the lesson. And it just seemed to me like a very interesting book of story news to me. I hope it was to you. Well, let's turn to the third chapter. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed down and did reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not down, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants that were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now, up until this point, he and Esther had kept it from them that they were Jews, because the world hated Jews at that time. All of them did. Right, so now then he tells them here, but as a true Jew, he could not bow down to anything or person, because only God was to be reverenced, and evidently this bowing down was an act of reverence that recognized him maybe as a part of deity. I don't know. But at any rate, doesn't tell us that. But at any rate, as a Jew, he wouldn't do it. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when Nebuchadnezzar set up his image and commanded all the people to bow down to it when the music started, they wouldn't do it. So they were put in the fiery furnace while God took care of them. So the point in all of these great lessons is, such as those three men, and also Daniel when he was cast into the lion's den, and because he had prayed to his God three times a day, now then Mordecai's refusal, all of this is showing that when an individual will do God's will and be faithful and subject to him, God's going to look after that individual. We're going to care for him. And I think it's a great lesson. All of these lessons in the Old Covenant are great lessons. It's still just as true now as they ever were. Right? So now he had told them that he was a Jew. Right? And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not down, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. Right? Just as God, wrath is spoken of throughout the Old Covenant, when people refuse to worship and serve him. Another parallel there in that. And that doesn't mean that God is like that. It's just a parallel in the different characteristics of this king and his rule and Jehovah and his rule, which are interesting to me, and I think that probably, although I don't know, is probably why the name of God does not occur in the book of Esther. It was left for them in this heathen land. It was left for them to see the parallel between Ahasuerus and Jehovah, and that Jehovah was able, therefore, had the power to save his people, able to save them in his providence. But he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had made known to him the people of Mordecai. So he wants to get rid of the whole Jewish race now, because they felt the same way toward him. He felt that Mordecai did, because it was for religious purposes that he didn't bow down to him. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. All right, now, so here's the part of the plot now of this story, of this the whole history, is that he is going to seek to destroy the whole entire nation. Now, the lesson is, one of the great lessons, God in his providence raised up a little orphan Jewish girl to the place of queen of his empire, that through her he might save his people. It's a great lesson on providence. I remember preaching on it one time here a long time ago, since I've been out here. But now notice, now the next verse, in the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. Now back in the first chapter, we had that it was in the 3rd year that he had that feast and called for Vashti to come before them. So now then, that means that 9 years have passed since that time. And then it was 4 years later, before Esther became queen, that would be in the 7th year. So now then, that means we're 5 years after Esther had become queen there. So Esther and I have been queen for 5 years. Now that may account for her hesitancy in going in before the king, because now then, after 5 years, well, probably the romance had worn off for him, and so she doesn't know what he's going to do when she goes in before him. But she goes anyway. Right, so now then, this is 5 years she's been queen. In this year, they cast pur, that is the lot. Now, the word pur meant casting the lot. And so the feast of Purim, or Purim, that grew out of the casting of lots here for when they would destroy the Jews. Now, know the next expression. Before Haman, that is the lot before Haman from day to day, from month to month to the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Now, that doesn't mean they would cast lots every day from the first month to the 12th month. They cast lots for one day, for each day of and for months, till finally the lot fell on the 13th day of the 12th month. So now then we have these 11 months in between, 10 or 11 months in between, for the preparation for their destruction. So it doesn't mean that they cast lots every day, but cast the lots for day by day or month by month till they came to the proper one. Now remember that such men as Haman were very superstitious, and they determined what they were going to do primarily by astrology. So as they would cast the lot or look at the stars or all of that, they would make their decision as when would be the proper time to do a thing. So now then it turns out the 12th month and the 13th day. That's what he's saying here. I'll point that out more clearly in just a moment. All right, it's in the 12th month, which is the month Adar. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from those of every people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them, to allow them to continue. So that's his charge now to Ahasuerus. Well, Ahasuerus had elevated this Haman to his right-hand man, Abizar, as they would call him, and now then he would listen to him. And if it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those that have the charge of the king's business to bring into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. So in other words, I'll just cancel that then, obligation there. But what Haman was intending to do was enslave the Jews to take their property to the point to this 10,000 talents of silver and pay the king out of the booty he would get from destroying the Jewish people. But there were a lot of them still in that country scattered. Not a great number of them went back home when they went back under the rubble, and Ezra and Nehemiah, a lot of them had, but not nearly all of them. So they were scattered throughout the provinces of Ahasuerus. Now then, so now then he's going to get this word to them and has 10 months to do it. But let me note another point here. Then were the king's scribes called in the first month on the 13th day, that is the day after he talked to the king thereof, and there was written according to all that Haman commanded unto the king's satraps and to the governors that were over every province, and the princes of every people to every province according to the writing thereof. So written in the language of the people to whom it was directed. Well, God did the same thing when he wrote his books of the Old Testament. He wrote them in Hebrew. Now that part of Daniel is written in a different language because it pertained to the Babylonian people while he was there. But according to the writing thereof and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and it was sealed with the king's ring. Right, now the king had given his ring unto, and that's the way they authenticated the thing back there. You had a seal on a ring, you put that on wax or clay or whatever it was, and that identified it as authentic. So now then he is authorizing this and authenticizing it by sealing it with the king's ring. Right? And letters were sent by post unto all the king's provinces to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for prey. Now that goes back. Now let me go back now and explain verse 7 in that light. So here in the first month, on the 12th day, the king of they cast pearl, that is a lot, before Haman from day to day, that is, to designate day after day after day, until in casting the lot on that day, the lot fell on the 13th day of the 12th month. So it doesn't mean that they cast lots every day for 12 months. But because these two passages down here in the 12th verse, that was the first month on the 13th day thereof, that would be the day after the 12th. Cast the lots on the 12th, on the 13th day, I mean, and it was determined that it would be the 13th day of the 12th month. I hope you follow. I had a little problem with that, but you have to get the whole picture. Now you come back over here now, so in this 13th verse, 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take this for them. A copy of the writing that the decree should be given out in every province was published unto all the peoples, that they should be ready against that day. The post went forth in haste by the king's commandment, and the decree was given out in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Why? Why are all these Jews going to be killed? Now, if he can kill that group of people, then maybe we'll be next. They're perplexed about it. Now, that raises this question. Either if it was going to be from the first month unto the 12th month, which will give you over 10 months, about 11 months in there between, why this haste? We're not told. But we wonder if the haste was not on Haman's part, hoping that the Jews, out of fear, would leave the country, leave their property, and he'd get hold of it, everything they had, without slaughtering all of them, although I don't think that would have bothered him much, but maybe they would revolt or something else, but he gave them time to leave. Now, we're not told why. I'm only throwing out a guess there, which I don't guess I've got the business doing, but that seems to me to be the logical thing. Now, if we give them time, maybe they'll leave the country, and we'll have the property, all the property, without having to slay them. But at any rate, they had this long time in there, and it is hard to understand why he waited, unless it was some purpose such as that. You have a suggestion? You have a thought on it? You have a question on it? All right. Well, that brings us down now to the fourth chapter. Now, all right. But all of this, you see, is just a history of it. What we're trying to get in chapter 3 in chapter 3 here, that's the history of Haman, his elevation, and why he hated the Jews so, because Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. So he's going to destroy the whole Jewish race. Now, the whole Jewish, the future of God's promise, that through the Jews he would bring the Messiah, that hangs now on a thread. But God is able to handle that situation. And that's to me, is one of the main lessons here. I think there are three lessons in this. One is the attempt here of the powerful people to destroy the Jews. All right? Then second, God raising up his providence and raising up a little Jewish maiden as the instrument through which they'd be spared. And then the providential events that take place here, the events here that lead to in the chain of providence, that are links in the chain of providence, that lead to the fact of how God spared them. How God did that. And those three lessons, I think, are very important lessons. Well, let's look at the fourth chapter now. This is, to me, one of the most important chapters of all. Now, when Mordecai knew all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. As with Mordecai now, as Esther's cousin, much older, who had taken her as a child and had reared her as a daughter. Right? And he came even before the king's gate, for none might enter within the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. Now, those old Persian kings, they didn't want anything unpleasant in their presence. You remember when Nehemiah went in before Artaxerxes, that he was trying to hide his feeling there, but Artaxerxes detected it. So why are you sad? That was not permitted. When he told him, Artaxerxes accepted it and let him go back and save his people, or rather build the walls of his city. Those Persians, so here he doesn't dare go into the gate there or near him in this sackcloth and in that condition. Right? And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and the decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews and fasting, and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now, praying is not mentioned. That was interesting to me. They fasted, they put on sackcloth, all that, but the fact that they prayed is not there, because the name of God is not in there. But I'm sure they were praying to God, for salvation, to save them from this destruction. But at any rate, this news had scattered all the empire. The Jewish people then were responding by putting on sackcloth, some of them, others wailing, mourning, weeping, fasting, and all that, and no doubt praying earnestly unto God. I'm sure that that brought a lot of those who had become indifferent. I'm sure that brought them back to the Lord. It has a tendency to do that. All right? And so that's that, what they did. And Esther's maidens and her chamberlains came and told it her, and the queen was exceedingly grieved. And she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take his sackcloth from off him. But he received it not. He wasn't going to take off his sackcloth. Now, she didn't know what it's all about, but he sent him sackcloth, and he's weeping and now and wailing. So she wants him to put on clothes and come on in and tell her what's wrong. He couldn't come into her presence, into where the king was in that condition. Then called Esther for Hathach, one of the king's chamberlains, one of the eunuchs that took care of the women of the harem, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and charged him to go to Mordecai to know what this was and why it was. So Hathach went forth to Mordecai under the birthplace of the city, which was before the king's gate. Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and the exact sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. All right, so Mordecai now tells Hathach. Hathach may come back and tell Esther what this is all about. Call upon her to do something now. Also, he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given out of Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him, and to make request before him for her people. So Mordecai sends all this word information now to urge her to go in and make supplication for the king, for the people. How is she going to do that? If you went in before the king uninvited, unrequired, if he hadn't sent for you, you just went in on your own, he would just wave a hand like that and off come your head there. It meant death. On the other hand, if he extended the scepter, why then that meant you were accepted, you'd come in. Now which will it be? So Mordecai then is asking her now to lay her life on the line by going in under Ahasuerus and making this request of him. But now they have another thing bothering the girl, woman. Here's old Haman. He'd been elevated in high place. He is right next to the king in all these matters. So now then, who's he going to believe, her or Haman? So that's a problem with her. So notice her response. When Hathach came and told Esther the words of Mordecai, then Esther spake unto Hathach and gave him a message unto Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, that is one law for him, that he be put to death, except those to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Right now, 30 days. So she hadn't seen him, hadn't been invited in. Now if she goes in, he may look at that in the wrong point of view, that she presumptuous, and put her to death. So you know what those old monarchs would do? Those old Persian, Babylonian, Assyrian monarchs, they'd kill you at the drop of a hat, drop the hat for an excuse to do it. And well, she doesn't know what the response would be. But now notice Mordecai's answer. This to me is one of the classics of the Bible. I've got a number of them. I put this among them. Notice his response. And Mordecai bade them return answer unto Esther. Here's his answer. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. Well, when he learns that you're a Jew, you'll be killed just like all the rest of them. Think you're going to escape now. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house will perish. Now this, and who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Now look at that just a moment. If you don't, you're going to die. And if you go in there and kill, you're going to die. So she doesn't have much choice, does she? It's going to be death. But there's a possibility that she'll find in a good humor and it'll extend the scepter unto her. So now when you got that word, don't look at that last expression, that deliverance will arise from another source. That shows faith in God. What is the source that he has in mind? God will raise up somebody else. Now then, and who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Maybe God raised you up to become queen in order to save your people for such a time as this. So it's a remarkable statement. I think I probably mentioned this before, so many things that I've already mentioned. But back in the 30s, early 30s, when I was preaching out here in Arizona, come out here to preach, I guess I must have been pretty discouraged. I had a good friend back in Abilene, Brother Shepherd. He was a preacher there. They'd taken a liking to me, about 20 years older than I was. But he'd taken a liking to me. We become very close friends and we corresponded. I wrote right to him, he wrote back to me. Well, I guess my letter must have sounded a little bit down a low. You know, he wrote back, and he quoted this passage, to be encouraged here, for who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Well, I leave that with God. I don't know whether he used me or I came to the kingdom for that time or what. But it gave me courage. I've always remembered this passage. Memorized it right then. Who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I've used it in making talks to young people. Who knows what God's going to do? He took a little orphan girl here, raised her up to the point of queen of the great Persian Empire, who was able to save her people from destruction. God was in his providence. God in his providence took Joseph, who had been sold into Egypt, who had been in prison, now in prison as a criminal. God took that lad, a slave there, one boy, raised him up second to the Pharaoh of Egypt, in order to save his people back there before they became a nation. Bring them down into Egypt where they would develop into a nation and he would deliver them from there. So those two instances, that of Joseph and that of Esther, one a lad, the other a lass. One of them here was put in prison. Here was one who was raised up to queen. But in both of them, God in his providence raise them up to that point to use them. Now, if you can get that across to young people, who knows what you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And encourage them to prepare themselves to do the work of God. Who knows? Nobody knows but God himself. And so, whatever I've been able to do in life, I didn't come to the kingdom, I'm sure, for any great event or anything, but God could use me to teach young people, to hold me, to preach to people, write a few books and things like that. Just like Joseph and Esther, raised over here at Wilcox. Didn't know anything about God and the Bible much, except what my mother taught me. She never taught me the Bible. I don't think Mother knew much back in then. She was a good woman. Great principle of right, strong character, and all that taught us principle of right. But I had to learn the Bible later on. So who knows? Who knows? If you've got a boy or a girl, or a granddaughter, or a grandson, if you can sit down and talk to that one, maybe you can talk to that. Turn to this passage. So look what God did with Esther. Who knows what he can do with you? The world's in a terrible mess. Church is in a sad condition today. Who knows what you'll come to the kingdom for such a time as this? I don't think we have to just go to young people. I think us older ones. God can still use us. Who knew which one of us has come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Something to think about, isn't it? All right. God in his providence that can do great and wonderful things. I move on. Alright, now I know. Then Esther bade them return answer unto Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, that was Susa there, Shushan the palace, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. Also, and my maidens, will fast in like manner, and so I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Now that's not despair. That's not a statement of fatalism. It's a statement of resignation unto her responsibility. I go in, and if I perish, I perish. If I don't go in, as when I find out I'm a Jew, I perish anyway. Because old Haman wouldn't hesitate to have somebody kill me before the king found it out if he wanted to save her. But at any rate, even he couldn't save her, because he issued a decree all Jews would be killed. He couldn't revoke that. And so, I'll go in, and if I perish, I perish. I'm resigned to that. Not despair, not fatalism. Sometimes, if the will of the Lord be done, kind of a fatalistic type of way of saying, sort of a despairing way. There shouldn't be that. If the will of the Lord be done, I should say that, meaning what I'm resigned to the will of God. Whatever be the will of God, I'm resigned to that. Not as a fatalistic despair, but as a resignation of faith. This is the way Paul used it. This is the way we should use it. But don't you hear it the other way sometimes? Well, I guess it's the will of the Lord, the will of the Lord be done. I would have said just about that tone. I'm sure you have too. But that's not it. If I perish, I perish. The will of the Lord be done. I'm resigned to whatever is God's will. Now to me, that's faith. That's the faith that I think God demands of us. All right. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded. All right, he went and told him. Now it came to pass the third day. Now that's another fact, and I know there was fast day and night, but now the third day. The time of the day of the first day here, the day of the beginning of one day, then the second day, here the third day, which are really not three whole days, but one whole day in between, whatever part of the first one and the third one might have been involved. Now this is the way the Jews counted the third day. Same thing is true with Jesus. He crucified on Friday, in a tomb on Saturday, raised on the first day of the week, 3 days. You count the day of the crucifixion as one. In the tomb was one. The day of the resurrection was one. That's 3 days there. Now you'll find that in the Old Testament. You'll find that in the New Testament. This is the way the Jews handled it. You say, well, it wasn't really 3 days and 3 nights. It doesn't make any difference what it was. This is what they meant when they said it. That's the thing I've got to recognize. All right, so the third year would be 1 year, the first year, the second year, and then the third year would be, well, you don't have 3 full years in there. They would call it 3 years. Okay. Put on the royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house. Now think how emotional that was. Think of the emotion of this young woman. I don't know how old she was. I'm thinking she's probably in the late 20s, maybe close to 30 now. But at any rate, still a young woman. Here I stand here. My life hangs in the destiny. On a thread. You extend that scepter or your sword. You want the other. Right? But put on a royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house, and the king sat upon his throne in the royal house, over against the entrance of the house. It'd be hard for me to figure out all that, but I know she comes where you can see her, where you're sitting on the throne in here. You can see her out here in the court here of this house. And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Now, in some old manuscripts, she reached over and kissed the top of the scepter. But either way, she touched it in recognition of response to his offering it to her of the scepter. Then said the king unto her, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther? And what is thy request? It should be given thee, even to the half of the kingdom." And Esther said, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." In other words, the fact that she'd already prepared it indicated there her faith, to him at least, that she believed he would receive her. And so she invites him to this feast now. You and Haman. I know then the king said, "Cause Haman to make Esther to make haste, that it may be done as Esther hath said." And so the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared, And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. Then answered Esther and said, my petition and my request is. Now she stopped. Why did not Esther tell him at that time? I don't know. I'll tell you what I think it was. I think it was a woman's intuition. She had an intuition that now is not the time. I'm not quite ready yet. So notice what she said. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I should prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. Now then, my request is you and Haman come to the banquet tomorrow night, and I'll tell you. But it just seems to me that here's a woman's intuition. Something is telling me this is not the right time. Something that more needs to be done. Right? And it wasn't, because Haman then did what he did between them. We won't have time to get that. I wish we did. No, I got to stop. I can't get this. But anyway, I'm going to start there at verse 9. We'll review it a little next time. But the point is, he must become so infuriated against Mordecai. So as he left, Mordecai still didn't bow to him. Oh, that made him mad. So he went in and told his wife and his friends about it. And I built a gallows, said 50 cubits high, twice so high. So when you hanged him up yonder, one of the people in the part of the town could look over yonder and see old Mordecai hanging on that gallows. We could put it, all you had to do just a few foot or two off the ground to hang him. He wanted him up there where everybody could see him when you hanged him. And so I think that all of this, so evidently, was an intuition of God by an old providence and his way of doing a thing. Sometimes we don't know why we made a certain decision. I think a lot of them are made that God directed us in it. But at any rate, I think it was God's providential act there, using her intuition to postpone the request until tomorrow. Give old Haman occasion to build the gallows that Mordecai, only he himself would be hanged. Well, I don't know whether you're going back and reading this or not, or whether you're paying attention to it or remember it. But I think if you were to sit down and read through the book of Esther as you would a short story, I think you would feel as I did, that I could hardly stop this. I had to stop. You didn't get to read all of it. But here the excitement and the emotionalism and all of that of intrigue and hate and and plans to murder and kill and all that, and the danger that the girl's life was in when she took him a hand and went in before. When you think of all those things, well, I think the story will become alive to you and you love it. All right, class is excused.